Yeah, I'm gonna talk mad shit for 2 hours about Scott. I'm texting his
I'm gonna
wife right
say.
now.
Hey, what's going on, guys? On this episode of Blood, Sweat, and Gear, we start out with the topic, guys that have great physiques but don't compete. What's up with that? Then we go to listener questions. We try to help a dude who's got some really serious knee issues, yet he's trying to grow his legs. Then we go over DHB, preferences, and dosing protocols. After that, we talk about Skip's sleep disturbances, why his sleep has been deteriorating. Spoiler alert, it has to do with evening GH dosing. And then from there, we go into just like a whole slew of training conversation. We're going to do all that right now here on Blood, Sweat, and Gear. Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Blood, Sweat, and Gear with Skip Hill. I'm Scott McNally. Our programming is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You could use our code ADVICES for some additional savings. Also brought to you by GetAzoff.com, one of the best nootropic blends that is on the market today. This is a topic that you brought to us. How? Tell me if I'm saying this right. Would it be bodybuilders that really could compete for, you know, all intents and purposes, have the physique to compete, but don't? And what are the mental barriers that keep a lot of really good people from competing? Am I saying that right?
Yeah, I think you're saying it right. Really, the way I look at it is there are so many gyms across, and I'm just talking about the country, let alone the, you know, the globe. But
sure,
there's so many gyms across the country that, you know, if you travel at all and you spend any time in other gyms, you see guys who are just freaky.
You do.
And you can see the structure and you can see the size and you can see the potential. And you just think, oh, my God, you know, this guy could just fuck some people up.
Yeah.
But the physical genetic component of competing and competing successfully and being good is, you know, obviously important. At the same time, my point is there's a lot of people with that potential that either won't be successful competing or they'll never compete because this game is such a psychological game.
It really is.
You know, and everybody likes to put numbers on everything. You know, oh, diet is 90% and training is 10%, and obviously it's all equal. At the same time, the mental component of this game and even competing to begin with, let alone being successful.
Yeah.
It's such a mental issue that there are just a lot of people with that structure. And, you know, and the other part that plays into it is a little bit of ego too, because some of these guys can have the structure and have the size. They don't have to work that hard for it because dieting, look, in my opinion, dieting and getting shredded is far more difficult than training to get big. Training to get big has a ego component. You get to, you know, walk around the gym.
You never have to take your shirt off. You can look big with a shirt on. When you get on stage, you can't hide anything anymore. That's
but
it.
You get treated like a king in a sense when you're a badass in your gym without having to really prove yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that work, the real work comes in when it comes time to get shredded. And that's the mental component. I think a lot of people who don't compete, I don't think would understand or even begin to comprehend the mental component with it being so all consuming.
Yeah.
I mean, all consuming kind of covers it at that point. But I just think a lot of people just don't have the mental fortitude to be able to do it. And it's not even, again, it's not even just do it. Doing it is one thing, but to actually do it and be successful. And, you know, you go to any gym, there's a handful of guys who could probably do quite well. They may not, you know, be like this cat here who's going to walk into North Americans and on a second attempt and get a pro.
He could be a favorite at this show. You
but
know.
There are people like that with genetics like that or similar to that, but they don't have the mental capacity to be able to put it all together or willing to make the sacrifice. And I don't even know if it's even sacrifice or discipline, because when you – I've said this a million times before. So listeners, I'm sure if they haven't heard me say it on the podcast, they've read it because I've written it somewhere.
Or they're just tuning into YouTube for the first time. They don't even know who you are. There's that.
That's a very good point. And I'm glad you remind me of that because I always think everybody knows. But there's the component that you – and I got sidetracked –
It's okay. That's what you do.
Bring me back. Yeah, I lost
about,
it.
About competitors, that guys that could compete but don't. I don't know where you're going beyond that.
Yeah, I don't. And I was going down the path and I lost it.
So well, I've got a bunch of thoughts on this one too. You know, so I can think, and I can only think of like maybe some specific people that I've known that, you know, there is an element of being that, like, the big guy at the gym. I'll go as far as to say, you know, the there's a component with some people possibly of the like perma bulking, because the second that they see anybody else like losing any kind of size in their shirt, they equate that with that guy lost muscle, you know?
Oh yeah.
They equate that with like that guy got small, that guy, you know, why would you work so hard to get so big only to throw it all away and diet down and, you know, step on stage looking tiny. You know, they well, I think that there's that element.
Who struggles more? You can look at all the open divisions at any show.
Yeah.
Your ripped guys, your shredded dudes are your middleweights and your light heavies typically. The higher that class goes and the higher the scale weight goes, the less shredded dudes you got. And yeah. The reason is that size. The second they start to give the big guys, when the big guys start to give up size,
yeah.
It's like they're losing their armor and yeah. They're losing that security and they struggle with it.
Yeah,
big time. So and I get it. I mean, if I was big like that, I wouldn't want to get small either. I don't have to worry about being a heavyweight or unless I miss a cutoff and I'll never be a super heavy. Well, I'll be a super heavy 3 days after a show.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I think I've never personally had an issue with dieting down because I've never been a huge dude. So
well, we have to go with our strengths. You have to go with your strengths right. too. And it's not size. Same here. That's how I came to the conditioning component. Yeah. I know that the only chance I've got, you probably feel the same way.
Absolutely.
I got to get shredded because if I'm not shredded there, I got no fucking chance to be beaten because I'm not fucking huge.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no question about it, man.
And I think one more thing that I think needs to be said too, with the big guys in the gym, if they're treated like the king and they're kind of a big fish in a small pond, getting on stage puts that all on the line.
Hmm.
So do they really want to do that when they already have this faux celebrity status at their gym and they can come into the gym every day and be treated like a king and everybody thinks they're a badass? Why would they want to go through putting their friends aside, putting all the fun stuff aside?
They don't have anything to prove.
Miserable. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, gosh, about the only thing in their mind that they think they could do is fail because everybody else already thinks they're gonna kick everybody's ass.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what it's like, man. It's tough. It's tough being a competitor too, because you know, you can look good in your, and I feel like anybody who is watching this knows, dude, this leads me to a whole other thing, and I don't know whether we even want to get into it or not. But I've had a hard time like accepting any kind of compliment because it comes from a place where I'm like, well, I better not, I don't want to like rest on my laurels. It's like,
or that angle was good. I chose that angle. There were five other videos I could have posted.
Exactly.
I looked like dog shit. That one looked a little better. So I posted.
It's like, it's hard to see yourself. And then it's hard to rely on other people's perspectives of you when you get so in your head, you spend so much time and only a competitor can understand what we're talking about right now. So I'm sorry if we're alienating any of the audience that hasn't competed or has no interest in competing, but it is such a weird, just weird mind fuck that you have somebody who tells you like, oh man, you know, everybody at work might tell you like, oh, you look so huge, you know? And then the next thing is like the same people, like my neighbor, for instance, he was like, dude, you looked huge a few years ago. I was like, oh, thanks, man. He's like, so do you ever do shows like that Olympia that you went to go visit? Like, have you been in that show? His concept of like what bodybuilding is like, he doesn't understand that there's a lot of people out there like that. So it's easy to start feeling like, yeah, I am huge, you know, when everybody in your gym is telling you that. But the reality is, man, yeah, well, just like you're saying, you could get definitely taken down a peg easily just going to a state level show and not being in shape, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And to hear you're shredded. I hear that too.
Yeah.
Like, shredded. I'm like, I'm 8 weeks out and I got a lot of fucking work to do, man. And on the other hand, you know, I want to be very clear. I appreciate the support. I appreciate the kind words. That's cool. And at the same time, it's like, yeah, you have to be careful too, because, you know, like you said, competitors, if you're not a competitor, you won't understand. There are a lot of competitors who still don't understand because they don't have very high expectations.
Oh,
there's two ways to compete.
Yeah.
You can go and you can try to fucking destroy what you did last time and destroy the field, or you can just go because it's a goal and a deadline, and you just want to be, you know, the best. You know, I just want to be the best that I can. I want to be better than I was last time. There's different, and look, neither one is right or wrong.
Yeah,
it depends on the perspective of that person, and every competitor, you know, can approach it any way they want to. But I mean, I don't want to look, I'm just speaking for myself, but I'm not going to invest the time, the money, potential, you know, health ramifications, to show up. I just
half-ass
don't want
it.
You know, that just is, I've competed enough that I don't ever walk off stage and just be happy that I finished the process.
Well,
that might be for the competitor who's competed once or twice. I get it. And I respect that. I did that too. I was like, oh my God, you know, I did this. Like, I fucking did. Cause not a lot of people do it. Not a lot of people can do it. Again, the mental component. So if you haven't done it before and you are able to do it a couple times, once or twice.
It's the first time is cake. After that, you've got expectations. Mm-hmm. You know, the first time you're just happy to be there.
That's a real good way to state that, because it's very, very true.
Yeah. The first time you're just like, holy, like for my first show, I got second. And then the guy who beat me ended up, he didn't win, not that show. He didn't win the overall. But the first show I went to, I got second place in middleweight. And I was like, and there was like 6-7 guys. And I was like, holy shit. I took out, you know, like 6 of these dudes. Mm-hmm. And I was 1 point away from winning my class. I was like, this is just crazy. And then from there, it's like, okay, so the next show, that means I got to win my class. You know, it's like from there, you know, it goes up. There was one other thing I was going to add to this, Skip. You know, when you say there's two different ways or different ways to compete, you and I, we're cut from the same cloth. And I don't know if this is, I don't know if it's a generational thing. I don't know if this is going to be just two old guys here going on about it. But to me, I've seen younger people that get into competing, and maybe they were around when I was younger too, I don't know, that do just kind of take it casually. Whereas I remember what I said on the phone to you was that for me, for us, people like us, bodybuilding is a rare opportunity that allows us to push ourselves like to our mental and physical limit. Absolute. Mm. There's so few opportunities in life to be able to push to that extreme. And to me, that's what bodybuilding is about. Being able to step on stage, knowing what 100% really is.
Yeah, it's definitely an old guy perspective. Because I completely agree with you. You're going to get a lot of old schoolers who feel the same way. Because the younger generation, and I'm not going to pick them apart. I understand there's just a different generation. It's a different time. But, you know, we can talk about social media and everything else. There's a lot of attention here. The focus, I think, sometimes is more on attention. Not only just, you know, from staying on stage. It's almost like some of them want to get on stage for the attention that they're going to get on social media. So to each their own, you know, that's fine. But I'm with you in the sense that I think you learn a lot if you're really invested, and it's a challenge to better yourself, and you're 100% balls in. It's, you just learn a lot about yourself, and it always changes. It's different for me now than it was, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 25 years ago. I think it constantly evolves, and the longer you do it, well, it has to evolve. I mean, it just has to, and it gets harder because you have more responsibilities. You have to try to balance your life and make sure that the rest of all the other eggs in your basket are not being put to the side so that you can come out a selfish asshole and then have problems with your daughter and then wonder if it's because, you know, you immediately go to the, oh shit, it's because I'm, you know, over here being selfish doing it. And it's like, no, I got to process this more. So yeah, there's a lot going on. You got to be able to balance that.
Hey, what's up, guys? I want to jump in and take a brief pause to shout out our great sponsors. First of all, I want to give a big shout out to our new sponsor, Azoth. You guys can go to getazoth.com if you want to check them out. They have a few products in the lineup now, from Azoth 2.0 to Total Focus and Pure Energy, both of those containing a new ingredient, Zynamite. It's a mango leaf extract. It basically is working as a coffee and caffeine replacement. And what it does is
It interferes with the breakdown of norepinephrine and dopamine. So meaning that will make other stimulants much stronger, but it will also help you to keep those feel good energetic hormones in your body for longer. So if you're interested in experimenting with nootropics and discovering the edge that they can give to you, then definitely check out getazoth.com, and we have the Amazon link in our show notes. Also, huge shout out to TrueNutrition.com. Thank you, True Nutrition, for supporting our podcast and for putting out high quality, third party tested supplements that we can depend on in the bodybuilding community. One of the things that I really believe about in True Nutrition is their pricing. Like I mentioned before, if you pay for 5 pounds of protein, first of all, it's just about wholesale prices. And then on top of that, you get 5 actual pounds of protein before they mix the flavoring in. That's something that you're not going to get if you go to a retail store. You'll get a tub, it has 5 pounds in it, and boom, that's it. This will be 5 pounds of protein plus the flavoring, comes out to about 6 pounds. So guys, definitely, they're a company that I have been involved with, a company that I have used, a company that I've suggested to my clients for a long time. They have tons of flavors, tons of different products. Check them out, TrueNutrition.com, and use our code ADVICES. All right, guys, we're back. Blood, Sweat, and Gear with Skip Hill and S2H. Oh, wait. Where is he?
I don't know. Like I said, his wife, I'm mad at his wife because she's not returning my text, especially when he's out of town. It doesn't even make any sense. So ooh. I'll have to take that up with her after the show.
We have some questions, guys. If you have any questions you want to ask here on the show, definitely post them in the feed. I'm going to start with some stuff we collected beforehand. Let's see. Okay. Jake had a good question, and this has to do with leg development. He says, so initially he asked about quad sweep and methods to grow quad sweep, but then you talked to him a little bit. He reworded. He said, I should reword my question. Methods for overall development of quad size with limited options. So here's the deal. He has some knee issues, and he's doing his best to figure him out. I mean, he's in Chicago. I work with him. He came all the way out here to Detroit to see one of my therapists to get him worked on. And she worked on him in tandem with another like physiotherapist so that they could kind of try to diagnose what was going on. And he's been getting some soft tissue work that seems to be helping to an extent. But he gets a lot of knee pain, and he has difficulty with like basically the compound movements, man. Funny thing is, Skip, when you look at his physique, you know, he's a younger guy. He's not, you know, he's not a huge dude, but a younger guy, you wouldn't necessarily think like, oh, his knees are fucked. You wouldn't look at his legs and be like his legs look decently balanced, believe it or not.
What is it with his knees? Like, where's the pain? What is the diagnosis?
That's the thing. They don't have it. They can't quite figure it out, but they have been finding that the more soft tissue work he gets, the better that it's working out. So he has issues.
Both knees. Not one.
Yeah. So he has issues with things like squats, you know, big time are a problem. You know, what,
can he change the position of the squat as an example? Mm. Can he, Smith machine that is not straight up and down, which quite frankly, there aren't any Smith machines, very few Smith machines left that aren't up and down. So with the angle of Smith machines these days, has he tried to use the forward versus the reverse, you know, sitting your hips further back, your feet further in front
of
you?
It's even like leg press he can't do, like hack squats. It's like everything is. So what was that initial question here? He says methods without any pressing or leg extensions due to knee injury, long-term knee issues.
Well, what can he do? I mean,
let's see. So he can't do extensions. He can basically like work his hamstrings. He can work in his adductors.
So I mean, any quad work is.
I mean, basically, he's shot, man, in that.
Lunges?
I think he can do a little bit of lunging. You know, I
and
mean, but
that points though to the hips being further back. I'm gonna just throw this out.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And the reason I say this is because it points to the fact that, you know, the hips are further back on a lunge than they are in, say, a squat or a hack squat or something like that. So if he were to try using like a belt squat, mm-hmm. where he can hang on and he can keep his hips as far back as they'll go, basically. And this is difficult to explain, but in a regular squat, and I think you can see here, in a regular squat, you got knee, foot, okay? The knee here and facing this way, knee, foot. Your knee is going to be, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but the knee is going to be, you know, it should be over the ball of foot. He needs to try to get into this area.
Okay.
And with a belt squat, he'd be able to do it because he'd be able to hang on to something to stay more upright. So then it becomes an issue with foot placement. How close to the machine, how far away from it? He's got to play with it and just see.
Yeah.
And look, it may not work. It may not help, but it sounds like he's pretty desperate. And this is a good point that I need to bring up too, is when people ask questions, and we love the questions. It's the basis of the show, but it's very difficult because I gave a kind of a, I don't want to say a generic response, but I gave a response that I would, that is true for 99% of the people until we got further into the issues that he's having.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, now it's a little bit different. I mean, to go back to his original question, how do I get more quad sleep?
Yeah.
Dude, I think you're not keeping the cart in the mirror wake of the horse. I'm fucking this up. You're not keeping the cart in the wake of the,
I still don't even know what you're trying to say.
Mayor, I know. I'm.
What is this? What is this?
I didn't say it because I didn't want to say it, but I'm really, really tired. I told you I was going to say it. I'm not going to tell anybody I'm tired because then they're like,
he told me that before the show.
I am. And that's why I lost track earlier when we got sidetracked because we got off and I couldn't come back. But
did
anyway.
Did you ever get your ass off, by the way? Did you get your ass off?
Did what?
Did you get your ass off? I did. Okay.
Did.
We got to talk about that after the show.
3 days ago, yeah.
Okay.
Have not used it yet, but point is,
obviously,
in a situation like this, he's just going to have to play with things, and he's going to have to play with the hips, play with the foot position to see if he can come up with something, because he's obviously very, very limited. May not work, but it might, because you said that he can sometimes do lunges, and that puts the hip, it puts the knee or the knee to the ankle more upright. So if he can get in a position like that on the belt squat, or pit shark, whatever the fuck you want to call it. It's a belt squat when it has a
Pit shark's just a brand name. Table.
Oh, okay. I did not know. Cuz I look at the pit sharks as kind of the lever versus the cable going up and down. But anyway, you got to be careful with that placement because you can be too far forward with the pull and it can pull against your knees if your knees bother you. And in this situation, it does. So you'd have to be further back. But the fact that you said that the lunges sometimes, then that may be a possibility. Outside of that, I mean, what I was getting at before was he's asking about quad sweep, but the truth is that's why I was saying he's putting the cart before the horse, because really what he's asking is, how do I train my quads without my fucking knees hurting?
Yeah.
Because quad sweep, I mean, I hate to sound like negative Nancy here, but dude, let's not even talk about quad sweep. You have to figure out how you're going to train your quads without pain first.
Yeah, that's a good point, man.
I mean, that's the number one thing. Really.
Two things here. Number one, we had like four people who finished your statement for you, cart before the horse. Like four people, it just all came up.
Well, here's the thing. That's not what I was going for. I was actually going for Schitt's Creek, a Moira. Statement that she made that I loved because I had to go back and replay it. What she actually said was to keep the cart in the wake of the mare. And I was like, did she? And I went back and replayed it. I'm like, oh, that's good. And if anybody's watched Schitt's Creek, they purposely wrote an A+ vocabulary into her character, and it was awesome because she would use words that are not all the time that are not used, and phrases that sometimes you have to go back and like listen to it again and go, oh my god. But the keep the cart in the wake of the mare, that's what I was looking for.
Okay. I was going to ask you questions about leg training, but I think I'm just going to I'll move on from here. And we hope that he can figure this out. I think you're right, man. You know, be creative and try. Oh, you know what? I will ask you this. Ray Hernandez brought up, what do you think about front squats? And overall, what do you personally think about doing front squats? I can't do them very well. I'm much better with back squats personally.
It's tough to breathe, man.
Yeah.
It's really hard to breathe. And a lot of people prefer to do them in the Smith machine. I know I do. And these days, like I said, without an upright, straight up and down Smith machine, which are, they're difficult to find, an angled one makes it difficult because then it has to angle in and it's an odd, you can't angle out because then it's hard. It's like the bar is getting away from you. It's hard to keep it, you know, where keep it comfortable. So it's possible, but at the same time, a lot of people still front squat. If you do them in the Smith machine, then you're able to keep that, that knee more upright above the ankle. But if you're not, again, it's going to kick it, not as much as a back squat, but it's still going to kick the posterior chain more. So in his particular situation, I won't say that it won't work, but I don't have, I'm not very confident that that would help him out much. I was even thinking too, what about the, and I don't like to call them a sissy squat, but they have that, where you put your feet in, it looks like a little, that can keep, could keep him back because it'll keep the knee directly above the, actually slightly behind, just slightly. That's a possibility too. I prefer that machine over leg extensions for rectus femoris development. I don't, it's not going to do a ton for quad sweep, but again, you know,
it's nice with, I've used that with supersetting with other exercises, which is brutal. We talked recently, Scott Stevenson and I did, about John Meadows. He put out one of those videos, like 21 reasons your legs suck type videos, or I don't think that was the exact phrasing, or your legs don't grow or something. We were talking about squat. He was talking about squat depth. And after that, man, it just, it inspired me. I can do, if I keep my feet, my heels elevated, I can do really, really deep, like all the way down squats. I can't use as much weight, but what do you think about a really deep squat? I'm not talking about for him anymore. I'm just talking about in general.
Deep squat. I've said this many times and I'll just say the same thing again.
Yeah.
You need to go as deep as you can before the hips start to turn under.
Yeah.
That's all. It's a flexibility issue. And it's not just the hamstrings. It's initially the hamstrings that will pull the hips underneath you. And that puts your lower back in a vulnerable position. But it's also equally as important. And this is why elevating the heels helps. The flexibility throughout your ankle with your soleus muscle. Hmm. Because if it's tight, it's going to be very difficult when your feet. Here's an example. When my knees are bothering me, I'm going to wear my elevated, like basically my squat shoes. When they're not, I'm going to be almost flat footed. I want like a, I always say verbatim. What is the name of the five toed shoes? It's kind of like, I always think of verbatim. It starts with a V. Anyway, it's the sole that is so flat. Merrill uses it. And then it starts with a V, and someone will kick it out who's listening. And I'll be like, yeah, that's it. But the point is if you're having problems with that flexibility, again, you're going to be able to get deeper. Even if you have tight hamstrings, you're going to be able to get deeper with the heels elevated.
I agree.
And it's funny because I said this like 3 years ago. I'm like, why does no one squat on plates anymore with their heels elevated? And it was clearly the industry did not listen to me. But it has come back around, because that was an 80s thing. You didn't squat without putting 10-pound plates down for your heels. You just didn't do it. And then it just went away.
Dude, it's a game changer.
It allows you to get deeper for that reason, because, again, if you don't have that flexibility, if you're flat-footed and you've got a flat sole, and a lot of people squat and chucks and things like that, which is fine, but there's no elevation there. You have to have that flexibility or you're not going to be able to get deep enough without what's called a butt wink. It's called a butt wink in powerlifting. And that's where the hips start. They come under and then they come back and they come under. And I see it these days because I've had so many chronic lower back issues over the years. And I just go, oh, my God, I'd blow a disc if that was me.
Yeah.
And it may not hurt you now, but do that and continue to butt wink for years. You'll create slowly over time degeneration, more degeneration of those discs, and you're just, it's a matter of time. Who wrote that? Randy Travis, matter of time. It's just a matter of time. Look it up.
Yeah, I loved him though. So after that video, I had such a good workout training at home that day. And I just spent the whole time squatting. I did some extensions and some curls to warm up, but it's just a nice squat rack, elevate your heels, feet nice and close together, and just work that weight up slowly, man. I feel like to me that is, it's I don't know. I'm going off on a tangent here. It's another worldly experience for me though. Okay.
Let me just add, I don't like the over, not overly dramatic, but the overemphasized elevation. When you start to get into the platforms, I'm not a fan. Mm. If other people are, that's fine. I think that if you start to get into extreme elevation of the heels, you're really putting a lot of stress on the knee, and the knee becomes vulnerable the more you do that.
Sure. I could add more, but we had a bunch, so I'll keep moving here. Intra-workout carbs, are they essential during a growth phase?
Well, I mean, define essential. I don't know that they're essential versus not essential. I'll say this.
Yeah.
If you can get away with them from a metabolism standpoint, and you're not just a endo that really puts on body fat easily, I would say carbs with EAAs in your workout water is a great idea. Even if you're cutting, I take them out when I cut.
Do you take them out right away? Like when you decide like it's time to cut, or is it?
No, I don't take them out right away, but I don't wait very long either. But the truth is I've never been, this is just me personally.
Yeah.
I've never been great with too much shit in my workout water.
Yeah.
I think that the more, it's a matter of fact, the more shit you have in your workout water, the more water you need.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because it has to be diluted enough or it's just going to sit in your gut. And when it sits in your gut, and you'll know it's sitting in your gut because you'll get distended, you'll feel full like you ate a fucking meal. Yeah. You don't necessarily have to be gassy. People will be like, oh, I don't feel gassy. Well, that doesn't mean you're not, descending and that it's not sitting in there. But then you have to have enough water. Well, can you get enough water and get enough of those nutrients to matter while you're training? I just do better on EAAs. That's just me.
I found that I love the plug for our sponsor, True Nutrition, the Mountain Dog Perry MD that they sell there. It's 25 grams of highly branched cyclic dextrin, and I believe like about 10 grams of EAA and a couple other things in there. It's fantastic though. And if I mix that with like even just 1 liter, I don't sense it in my stomach at all. Whereas back in the day, I used to use a lot more. Like when inner workout was real popular, we had worked up to like 250 grams. You could turn it into like another meal, And we would be doing these 2.5 hour workouts and have to drink a gallon, It's just it was labor. You had to really work up to it. So
I think it's important, but I do think that it's overrated. I'm happy to see the intra workout
hype.
Fad.
Yeah.
Yeah, hype is better. Hype is better. The intra workout hype kind of pass.
Yeah.
It's good and it's beneficial, but it still was overhyped there about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
4 or 5 years.
Anybody who's real new to bodybuilding, you might have missed that. But yeah, we were all like, I mean, like I said, man, there were points where we're like, I'd have to buy like 2 tubs of $60 carbs every month, just because you're just dumping, you needed a funnel just to dump that stuff into a gallon jug. And
that was the focus of the supplement industry at that point. So everything cycles. I mean, everything goes through, things like that. So
I think EAAs have stuck around more though. You know what I mean? Like
for good reason. Yeah.
Yeah.
For
good reason. Yeah. I'm a big fan
good
of those
stuff
too.
Always does.
Yeah.
The stuff that actually works does. It always sticks around. It always hangs around.
Now with a client, because you mentioned, you said you personally, do you mean like pulling them out early in a diet? Is the same thing with a client too? If you need, because obviously when you're going to try to diet someone down, you're looking at the diet and you're like, okay, we have to remove some form of carbs. You'll go toward those intra carbs pretty early.
Yeah. There's a lot of variables there. One that stands out that it needs to be mentioned is when do they train? What time of the day do they train? If they train early in the day or they train fasted, they become that much more important, especially in a cutting phase.
Yeah.
But I this is what I do. And this is actually another important component as well, is if they're not hungry for their post-workout and they struggle to get it in, that's a pretty good indication that they have too much intra of something, and it's usually carbs. The other thing is I think that you have to be very careful when you're using intras that you cut back on your post-workout carbs as well.
True. You don't need them.
Don't. Yeah, a lot of people don't. They're like, well, I'm going to go, you know, 35 or 40 intra, and then I'm going to go 60 or 70, you know, post-workout. I tell you what, you got to be pretty fucking big dude with a pretty good metabolism to get away with that many carbs post-workout when you've already hit 40 while you're training.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just depends. It depends on the rest of the carb intake the rest of the day and stuff like that. But the timing of your workout during the day is very important based on whether the intras will stay in there or be in there to begin with during a cutting phase. But, you know, what is their somatotype? Are they, do they struggle to lose body fat? Have they been shredded before? Do you not, they've never been shredded before, so you don't know how hard or how easy this is going to be. Yeah, I'm probably not going to have intras in there right off the bat. I'm going to be start to strip, you know, body fat and then see. And then maybe if things are going well and their metabolism is in a good spot, then we can put them in and see how they do. But there's a lot of variables there.
All right. One from Woody here on the live feed. He says, thoughts on growth hormone, TB500, BPC-157, and recovery from neck surgery. And he also asks for dosages on that stuff.
Well, you know me and peptides. I'm going to go straight to GH. And okay, for those who don't know me and don't know my background, the reason I say that is because GH is tried and true. It works incredibly well, the best of, I mean, in my opinion, 10 times over what the peptides do. Plus, it's not as, the dosing protocol isn't as complicated. The timing isn't as critical.
Well, these things, I'll get into it, but these things are going to be a little, the BPC is different than, it's not a, yeah, it's not, yeah, like the GHR, you know, the GHRP6 and all that stuff. You like, you have to take it on the cusp of a full moon, but you have to make sure not to eat anything for 30 minutes. You know,
yeah, it, I was like, going to leave the BPC to you
right,
because I know you have more experience with that than I do. I'm aware of the effects, but I do not personally know because I have not used it personally.
All right.
And I think I've told you before, I have my concerns because with BPC, because a lot of people are adamant that it heals so quickly. My question is, and I continue to question this, is does it actually heal or does it actually mask pain in some way? Because to heal something that fast, I mean, people respond to BPC very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And I struggle to think, even with tendonitis, that BPC can take care of it that quickly.
I'll get into it then. But tell me then, so before I interrupted you, you were talking about the dosing of how you would put GH together.
Well, I mean, it depends on past dosing and things like that. If you're doing it strictly for healing, I mean, it's clearly will be, you know, beneficial. I mean,
yeah,
AAS and or growth hormone, something like that is going to help to speed recovery, no matter if it's training or whether it's surgery related or an injury, that sort of thing. As a matter of fact, I'd make a blanket statement and just say this. If anybody's ever wondering if they have an injury, if they should continue their cycle, whether it be, you know, AAS and or growth hormone, the answer is absolutely yes. Don't come off the things that will help you to recover from that injury quicker.
Yeah.
Stay on them. But as far as dosing, I mean, that's difficult because what is your past dosing? What is the dosing that you're on? The older guy who's never used anything, who's 40 years old or in their 40s, you know, 3-4 IU of growth is pretty damn good. And it can make a, you know, it can be pretty impactful. To someone who's 22, 3-4 IU of growth, it may not be as impactful as someone who's 45.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, I hate to keep saying variables, but there's just a lot of variables there.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. I can tell you too. I'd used growth when I was younger, and I didn't notice it the way I notice it now. Like I could tell that it was there, and I got more, you know, fullness from it. But the quality in my 40s now, early 40s, guys, I get my recovery is improved. There's no question about that. So BPC. I really do think that it heals. I think that there's an element of anti-inflammatory going on because I don't know how something could be just like regenerated, you know, that quickly. But I'll tell you, and here's why I think it's anti-inflammatory too. So I only use it really now if I get like a tweak. And usually what I end up getting a tweak in is like a bicep tendon. So I go to kick dumbbells up and it feels wrong, and I'm trying to train at home on my stupid home workout setup, which is not nearly as good as at a gym. And so because of
the equipment isn't, it doesn't work as effectively. I can't lift things as efficiently. Then I end up tweaking something. That happened right at the beginning of the quarantine. And it was at the point, Skip, where that top, just like the very top of that bicep tendon was just nagging at me. And it got to the point where I could feel it when I wasn't doing anything. That's bad, you know.
Yeah, or while you're sleeping or something.
Yeah, yeah. I had to watch the way my arm was and stuff. And finally I said, you know what, I'm going to take some BPC. And I broke it out, took a shot, and literally 2 hours later I was getting ready for bed and I realized, I don't feel it anymore. I don't feel it anymore. And of course I still was careful with it. But, I mean, it's not that I really did anything to mess it up to begin with. I did something wrong for just a split second and it just strained it a little bit. You know, I'm not like repeating that movement. You know, it was something where the dumbbell just went in the wrong way for just a split second. So it's not like I didn't need to take a break or anything. Basically, I was able to just continue training like nothing changed. And, you know, I used it for maybe just like 5 days. And then after that, man, I was 100%. I do think that there's something to it. And like I said, man, I got to think that there's some type of anti-inflammatory quality to it. Now, dosing wise, I'll use it differently. Like I think I've heard people do like anywhere from like 250 to 300 micrograms and they'll take it twice a day and they inject it right directly close to the site as possible. I found that maybe I've done like 1 milligram, 1,000 micrograms in one shot every day and maybe for only 5 days. And I found that for issues like what I just mentioned, it'll be fixed in a heartbeat. So I love the stuff, man. I keep like a couple boxes of it on hand just in case something happens now. And I do find it that I never put it this way, Skip. I never wish anything to happen to you. I don't want you to get hurt. But when you do, I am adamantly going to suggest, like, dude, listen to me on this one, man, because it is that good. It's that good. And I have experimented, too, with, like, the other peptides. When we talk about peptides, we start thinking about, like, dude, like, we've been around. Like, think about what do peptides mean now versus 2006. It's a different right. world, you know?
Sure.
And that shit, what was it, sermorelin? And, you know, all things like that. And then we got into like the CJC with and without DAC. And yeah, all those complicated protocols. This is a different world than that stuff. And it works in a completely different way. So I'm definitely a fan. I can't comment on TB500. I know that you can combine the two and that does specifically, they say, work as an anti-inflammant. I haven't used it. I know that BPC, body protection compound, is produced in the gut and it is good for recovery. They're doing tests now for people with Crohn's. You could use it orally. And what I'm hearing is that helps more in a digestive fashion than when you use an injectable. So I don't know. I don't know anything more than that. I'm not a specialist in the stuff, but just as a bro and as somebody who's had personal experience, I could say, you know, go for that one.
Well, let's do this. Why don't you send me some?
Okay.
And I will combine it with my DHB because the muscle that I inject DHB is debilitating.
Yeah.
And if it wipes it out, then I'll be like, oh my God.
It neutralizes
Scott is a fucking genius. Yeah. I had to laugh. I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to use any Nolitol in my shoulders the day before a show. I'm just going to use DHB. Mm.
So it's a DHB that's dihydrobuldenone, right? Or. Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically one test sip. Yeah.
One test sip. Now, what do you like about that so much?
I really like it because number one, it doesn't aromatize. It's kind of like, you know, the EQ family. I mean, I'm a big fan of EQ anyway. But I'll be honest with you. I laugh about the and joke about the inflammation, but kind of nice too.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it's debilitating, that's different. I mean, I've hit my quads and then limped for 4 days. I mean, it's like, oh my God. But then if I, you know, I hit my shoulders and it's right and it's good, I'll be like, damn, I wish I could look like this all the time. I got to take more of this shit.
So lay it on us. What does a protocol look like going into a contest with DHB? I used it once before for a show. I looked great too. It was a really good, really good look.
Well, I won't give mine away.
Okay. But
I
would
say, you know, if you're at 300 to 500, you know, it's kind of I don't want to say it's a prop dosing, but it's 100 mg per mil.
Okay.
You don't need a ton of it. It's more of like a, what do I want to say? Like an addition to a cycle versus like if you're a newbie and you don't have a lot of experience and you're not in advanced cycle mode,
yeah.
EQ is going to be fine. But if you're kind of in an advanced cycle mode, it's good shit. It's pretty good stuff. So in the 300 to 500 milligram a week, you know, three being obviously a little bit more conservative, but you start to get up to 500, 600, 700, you know.
I felt like I got a really vascular look from it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say it's EQ on steroids, cause that's not, you know, EQ is just, it's EQ and it's still a boldenone, but it's, so I don't know that it's dramatically different. I just look when it comes to esters and stuff, I'm more of a fan of shorter esters. I'm less of a fan of longer esters.
Okay. Yeah.
EQ is kind of the exception in that sense because it's one of the longer esters that I really do like. But you know, you've heard me say a million times, so have some of the listeners, I'm not a fan of DECA. I hate that shit.
Yeah.
But I can do NPP. Like NPP because it doesn't blow me up as much. And again, if you're lean, the longer esters aren't going to blow you up as much anyway. I just look from a longevity standpoint, being older, the lower I can keep my blood pressure, the less amount of water that I can hold, the better. And shorter esters tend to do that for me.
How long do you feel like did it take like an extended period of time or anything to kick in with DHB any different than anything else?
No. And admittedly, because it's an addition to the cycle, it's difficult to pick up and go, oh my God, it just kicked in.
Yeah.
You know, very difficult to do because I haven't taken it by itself or with one compound. I take it with six.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure I'd have to fucking count them, but I'll prescribe by my doctor, by the way.
Of course. I've got a picture here. This is, I'm going to post this up for everybody. This is when I weighed 173 pounds. And I used DHB. It was a good look. I was happy with that.
You got to be careful with DHB. Let me throw this one thing in here, too, because it's important.
Yeah.
You got to be careful with it because it sometimes will not stay suspended.
Yeah?
It'll crash. And it crashes relatively, especially if it gets cold. I'm talking very fast because I'm tired. I apologize.
It's all right.
You have to pay attention to the point where every time you go to dose it, to pull it from the vial, you want to make sure it's not crashed. If it is, you got to vent it and you got to heat it. Because you think it hurts when it's suspended.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that'd be bad.
Don't want it. Yeah, it's not good. And I mean, really, I laugh. It's not funny because if it's crashed, you got a pretty good chance of getting an abscess at that point.
Oof. Yeah. Yeah, that'd be brutal.
Nobody wants that. I've been fortunate because I've been doing gear for, I don't even know, 25 years. And I have not, knock on wood, I shouldn't even say this, but I have not had any issues with abscesses.
Yeah. Let's keep it that way, Skip.
Yeah, exactly.
As you talk about like using this DHB that's like causing all sorts of issues for you. I just sent you over one of my pictures from when I was on DHB to inspire you for your prep. I was 173 pounds there. Let's see. I'm going to find another question here. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, that was me.
Wow.
That was my second show ever.
Jesus. God, when you're lean and tan, you're not bad looking.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that.
I mean, you could read it the other way.
No. All right. We've got a question here on nootropics. Nootropics, with so much banned in the last 15 years, which current supplements actually work? Note, I'm completely tapped out on caffeine and L-tyrosine. That's funny. Skip, you've got some nootropics at home.
I do. They were sitting right here, but I put them in my oral drawer.
Yeah.
In the bathroom because I was not taking them because they were sitting here, quite frankly, so I kept missing them. I'd sit down on my computer later in the day and went, aw. So I have not tried them yet. My question to you is, which one do I try first? Because I don't know anything about them. The one, like as an example, the one has a couple ingredients, but then the other one has a couple of the same ingredients plus one.
Yes.
So
here's the deal. You're talking about, I think I have them all here. Two of the three here. So there's Pure Energy and Total Focus. And Pure Energy is the one that's just like the standalone. Total Focus has that same thing, Zynamite, in it, along with Pure Cath, which is just a small dose of a particular type of caffeine and a particular type of rhodiola. Now, this is interesting. So I talked to Prady, the owner of the company. I didn't know this, but he said that wrote, so this relates to nootropics. Different types of rhodiola extractions will give the rhodiola a different effect.
Oh, okay.
I had no idea. Like, if you do it at 60%, you can get more of a stimulated effect. If you do it, which I don't know if that's true, I just made that number up. If you do it at 40% or something, then you get more of a relaxed effect, and it's better for, like, recovery. So I have no idea on that, but I think this is more for stimulating. So here's the deal. The main thing that's in that is a patented ingredient called Zynamite. We just put out a video today. It's about 10 minutes long. It's at Think Big Bodybuilding Media. I posted it up in the advices group for Rick, who asked this question. I'm interested in this. I started using it. I started checking it out. And this isn't like just to plug the product. It also comes in. There's one other product in the U.S. that carries it, and that's Morphogen. And what this is it does a few different things. It works completely different than coffee. And what they're saying is, with the studies, they're looking to replace coffee with it, basically. So it's a stimulant, but the way it works is that it blocks the reuptake of norepinephrine and dopamine. And so by working that way, then the natural stimulants that you produce, you just continue to, ride off of those for a longer period of time. When he says, I love L-tyrosine, he mentioned he's burnt out or tapped out on caffeine and L-tyrosine. L-tyrosine is a great nootropic. I get that from just True Nutrition, and it comes in a little pouch for like $6. It's like a whole prep's worth. And I don't know if you've ever had people use that, Skip. It's also beneficial for like thyroid and, right, good for appetite suppressant for some people. And I like it. Gives me more, I'll say like anti-fatigue, not really stimulant, but like anti-fatigue. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, to plug our product, sure, I would definitely go to getazoff.com. We have links in all of our shows. But just in general, like, what is good? I'm really turned on right now to Zynamite. I think that that's something that's interesting for energy. Some of them, I'm trying to think. Let me look at the actual Azoff
and
product.
And don't take it later in the day.
God, obviously. No. Right. No, don't take it now, Skip, unless you're staying up all night. Alpha GPC, they're putting that into a lot of stuff now. Like, I'm seeing that alpha GPC and a lot of pre-workouts. Teicrin is in this as well. Huperzine A is one that I really like. You can get some of this stuff like gray area, because he mentioned in the last 15 years a lot of things have been made illegal. You can still go to places and get like NOPEP, which is it's a pretty strong nootropic. But, honestly, I like what our sponsor Azoff sells. So, I hate to make it sound like a plug, Skip. I really do. But I think that they make a good product. So if you're looking for something like that, then, I would check those out.
And for the record,
yeah,
you're not going to have sponsors, whether it be a protein or nootropic or anything else, that isn't solid and isn't quality. So for the listeners who don't know, it's not like you're, well, okay, we'll just,
what are we going to hawk off on people today?
Yeah, we'll just grab this and we'll try to push this on our listeners.
Yeah. I'm trying to see if anybody else put any questions in the thread here. I know we have some other stuff. Skip, I wanted to ask you a question about your personal growth hormone experience. So lay it on me, man. I'd been waiting to hear about this. What's happening with it?
Well, I can't sleep. We went over that prior to the show. It's funny because I'm thinking to myself and I'm getting really frustrated. First, I have to say and be very clear, I don't have sleep issues. I mean, I'm 50 years old now, and, my wife really struggles with it because she's got central apnea and that sort of thing. And I always say, I'm like, God, I've been fortunate that I've never had. Doesn't matter if I'm on trend. Doesn't matter if it's prepping. I will sleep like a fucking rock. But man, the last 3 or 4 weeks, last night, what really happens is I fall asleep. I'll get 2 hours. I got to get up and pee. I get another 2 hours. I get up and pee. And damn it, if I'm not wide awake and it takes me another hour to go back to bed. Yet my Fitbit says, oh yeah, you were in REM sleep. No, I wasn't in REM sleep. I was fucking awake, motherfucker. This isn't even accurate. So it's getting frustrating. So I'm racking my brain. I'm like, This is not trend because I've not had problems on trend before. I'm not so depleted. I'm not hungry. Sometimes people, when they're hungry, they'll sleep poorly.
Yeah, me too. I get that.
I'm not ravenously hungry or anything to that point. I don't have a lot of it. And people struggle with this because they think, oh, you skip loading. So, you know, you must just have this. I have an appetite because I like good food, but I am not hungry to the point where I'm like, oh my God, like I can't wait to, I got to eat. I need carbs. Oh my God, I got to eat. I'm starving, that sort of thing. So I'm trying to figure it out. I go back through my Fitbit. I'm looking and I'm like, you know, my sleep started falling off middle of April. Wait, where are we in June? Middle of April. I'm like, oh my God, I just switched from dosing my growth hormone once a day in the morning.
Yeah.
I increased it from five. It was 5 IU in the morning. And I increased it to 4x2, one in the morning, one before I went to bed. Within a week, thank God I keep good notes. Within a week, my sleep score was going down and has continued to deteriorate relatively consistently until I'm at the point now where I'm like, what the fuck is going on? So I have to move. It's just so obvious. It hit me like a brick. And, you know, some people say, well, my God, you know, how could you not figure that? Well, I'm in prep. There's a lot of shit going on.
Yeah.
You know, I've got things. I'm taking more things than usual. And there's just a lot on my brain and family stuff and quarantine and.
Yeah, because I had wondered if it was like maybe a stress thing was.
Exactly. And that's what I went to as well. And I'm like, you know, God, I'm not really all that stressed right now. Financially, I'm cool. Business is cool. I don't have anything that's really weighing me down other than, you know, the family issues that we were dealing with. But that was brief. The problem was prior to that.
Yeah.
And it was deteriorating to the point where it's just gotten bad recently. And this last week was actually good. And yet my sleep is the worst it's been. So it's very clear for me. I don't know about anybody else, but the dosing at bedtime it's gone. I'm done with that.
Interesting.
I have to move it to either post-workout, which would be about 6 hours prior to bed, which is probably what I'll do.
Okay.
Or just go to two daily doses.
I know. So I don't know, you know, the science behind this. I know Dr. Serrano, Eric Serrano, Victoria's mentor and doctor to John Meadows, had said that he thought the best timing for growth hormone, and this is a few years ago, for somebody who was interested in building muscle was before training.
Mm-hmm. Yep, very possible. And I say very possible because, first, I'm not going to go against a doctor.
Sure, one, right.
And I'm definitely not going to go against Dr. Serrano because of his reputation and his, you know, his background related to bodybuilding and that sort of thing. The only thing that I would say is this. And I have spoken behind the scenes to a lot of, you know, top trainers and friends of mine, things like that. We all kind of laugh because we always want the best and most optimal use of the compounds that we're using. We split hairs and we're like, you know, this was good, but I just make it better. And damn near every person I have spoken to agrees with me. And we're all on the same page that really, if you're responsive to growth, the timing doesn't matter as much as whether you just actually respond to it or not.
I'm totally with you. 100%.
Yeah, I think, and it's not like we don't want it to be right. We want it to be the best that it can be and get the most bang for your buck. And, you know, you want everything that you're taking and everything that you're doing to be as optimal as possible. But I can't disagree with that. You know, I've taken it pre-workout before. I've taken it post-workout. The problem with growth is you're not going to see and be able to really quantitatively evaluate what is better. You might be able, as insulin is the same way. It's difficult, at least with insulin, you can see if you're getting fatter or not over time.
And if you take a pre-workout, you might get more of a pump. That'd be the only thing I think you might think, you know, you'd see besides the fat thing, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, with growth, it's certainly a possibility. Here's what I don't like about pre-workout.
Yeah.
If I'm taking something pre-workout, whether it be, you know, IGF or whatever, I want to take it at the gym. And I don't like taking loaded pens with me and feeling like, you know, I have to go into a bathroom in the gym. You know, I'm at Miami Iron, that's different. They have a biohazard bag. But I still don't, or not bag, box. I still don't want to do that. That's just that's not my thing. In the car, you know, you feel like junkie and you're like, I don't want to put it through my shirt sleeve. And
then
I
got to pull up
my shirt or I got to do this or that. It just becomes kind of a pain. Oh, I forgot my shit today. Oh, goddamn, I got to go back. Yeah, I'm halfway there. I got to go back to you know, back home and get my shit because I forgot, things like that. So I can't argue with it. It may well be. When it comes to those type of recommendations, it really comes down to Dr. Serrano has some reason on paper,
yeah,
that it makes sense and is optimal. And I can't disagree with that. It may very well be.
Yeah, I found for me, it works because any gym that I train at, most of them are going to be 15 minutes away or less. So I just take it right before I walk out the door, you know? So that's my game plan. That works. I've done that. I've taken it with me and I felt, and I'm like at that point where I'm like, yeah, I don't really need to get it right before I train. I have taken IGF with me to the gym and taken mm-hmm. that like right before I train. And I'm not I'm with you, man. I'm not a fan of like driving around with that stuff. And
yeah,
you know, I don't want to be that guy. Is out there. There's a lot of that guy in bodybuilding nowadays.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm not going to sit here and knock it. I don't feel comfortable. And I've used gear for years.
Yeah.
I mean, fuck, 20. I was trying to figure it out earlier. I don't even know how many. 25 years? 20? Certainly 20. And I don't want to fucking do that.
I can't blame you.
I don't feel good about that.
I can't blame you. Listen, we've got a question here about exercises to avoid. When you he just says exercises to avoid for low back issues. You already mentioned the butt wink with squatting. You don't want to squat that low. What would be some of the other prime things that could, say, create a back injury, really, I guess, is what he's looking for here.
Well, it's not even just squatting. Leg pressing is
low back disc herniation.
Yeah. Angle leg pressing is overlooked a lot because
– yeah.
With compression, when the spine is compressed, if your hips turn under you, a lot of people can get away with that before they can get away with the hips turning under you or coming off the pad is a better way to explain it. When you're on a leg press, very dangerous. Setting a T-bar row down is now old school one to the floor, not that much of a stretch. But if you get on an Atlantis, as an example, T-bar that, you know, is set, like the bar itself is set between the platform. That's a long way to pull that weight. I mean, you're literally, that's like it's kind of like having the bar be on the floor and you're pulling it dead to start. And 9 out of 10 times, I don't know if you do this, but I do this. You don't start your set from the bottom position. You pick it up, stand up, get your footing, get your grip,
back over.
And then you go back in. Exactly. So I've actually injured myself. I herniated a disc putting the T-bar down.
Holy shit.
Like, yeah, not picking it up, but putting it down and literally heard the pop, knew I was fucked. It was probably number 3 or 4 of the 9. But anyway, this is years ago. But the point is T-bar rows, and it's not the actual row itself, because when you're rowing, your erectors during the set, whether it be barbell rows or T-bar rows, your erectors are basically just stabilizing. There shouldn't be much movement. There's going to be a little bit because you got a little herky jerky starts and stops. What was that? Tony Robbins, herky jerky starts and stops. Anyway, somebody will get it on an infomercial. I think it was Tony Robbins years ago. But anyway, your erectors are a stabilizer in that sense. And they are, whether you're pulling deads or anything else. But the point is there's more movement, more hinge movement in the back when you're pulling from the floor. And that's what happens with T-bar. So you got to be careful with things like that. The angle leg press, squatting when the hips come underneath you. One arm dumbbell rows, the rotation.
Oh, yeah.
People over-rotate on this. And I honestly, I think it's as high as 7 out of 10 people, especially when they get heavy. There's too much rotation on with a lot of weight on the lower back.
Yeah.
Bad idea.
Yeah, because you can use your hips basically to lift that weight when you start fatiguing. I think that's what I see happening.
You know? It's just by rotation, I mean you're twisting.
Yeah, yeah.
You're rolling, but you're twisting. And technically, there should be no twist. Yeah. The only thing that should be twisting or coming across, and there's a chiropractor would know this, or a physical therapist, and I can't think of the word, but you're pulling the rhomboids in the middle traps to the middle of the back. And this is what people do. They don't do that. They do it, but they don't do it keeping the hips stabilized. What happens is this. So you get this twisting going on in the lower back with, you know, in these days, people are pulling, you know, 150s, 180s, 200 pound one arm dumbbell rows. Yeah. And you're better off cutting that weight down and not twisting and putting the lower back in a vulnerable position and pulling the way you're supposed to be pulling. I'm not a big fan. I don't want to get off on a tangent, but I'm not a big fan of overloading row movements anyway.
Yeah.
I rarely see a T-bar or barbell row done correctly. Dusty Hanshaw is the king. If you want to see how to fucking pull bent rows or T-bars, watch Dusty because he's the fucking king. Plus,
he was built for it.
But he's pulling retarded weight. I mean,
it's insane. It's insane.
Nine and a half out of 10 people are pulling more weight than they should. The T-bar looks like shit. It's either jerky and it's a bicep movement.
Yeah.
And if you really watch, if you're not sure, watch someone pull six or seven or eight plates on a T-bar and you will see that the main movement, the main action is in the biceps and not as much in the back anyway. So, you know, if you're not sure, watch the elbows. It's the path of the elbows, not the bar.
What do you see in the path of the elbow that would tell you it was a bicep?
Well, the more the elbow moves, the more the back is working. The more the bar moves, if you just watch the bar can move.
Uh-huh.
But the elbows don't need to because a part of that can be curling.
Oh, I see. Gotcha.
It's the elbows that matter. Another example of that is a pec deck squeeze where, again, it's elbows. You're here or you're here. It's elbows. The hands are in the same place.
Yeah.
But if your elbows are wide, you're losing 6-8 inches of that range of motion.
Sure.
You have to I've written so many. I've probably written 6 articles on elbow position.
Huh.
The elbow position is vital for full range of motion, whether it be a row, whether it be a press.
Yeah.
All that shit. It's just side lateral. Same thing. You can see a dumbbell go higher. You know, a lot of people will have their dumbbell 6 inches higher than the elbow.
Yeah.
It's the elbow. It's where the elbow, it's the range of motion from the elbow when you're dealing with back movements and chest and shoulder movements.
Hmm. I'm still thinking, okay, so that lateral raise, what am I seeing that's wrong? Do you see the elbow leading?
No, the elbow can lead. Ideally, it's right with the wrist.
Okay.
But if the wrist gets higher than the elbow, that's where you get into, because visually, your mind is focused on the actual dumbbell stuff. So you're thinking yourself, the dumbbell's as high as my shoulder, I'm good.
Yeah. But you're actually doing like one of those is what you're saying. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. That's
an exaggeration, but you're making the point.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I could see that, man. What do you think? Just kind of going off on a tangent here with training, what do you think about shoulder growth, shoulder development? Would you say that lateral raises or overhead press are going to be more of the big growth movement?
Excellent question. That is so misunderstood by a lot of people. Press behind neck is a side lateral movement and it's king. And people go, what? It's a side lateral movement. You're not getting much front delt activation versus the side delt. It's a stabilizer, primarily a stabilizer. You move to the front, then you're getting more front delt activation.
Yes. Yeah.
So, and it depends too, whether you're in a Smith machine or if you're on a machine, a fixed machine, that sort of thing. The point is behind the neck presses are incredibly underrated for shoulder development because we've gotten into the last probably 15 years ago, probably, where it's such a vulnerable, it's just not made. The bar should not be behind the head. The bar can be behind the head as long as you have flexibility in your shoulder throughout your shoulder complex that allows you to do that. The bar doesn't should down on your traps. You shouldn't press the bar from your traps. The bar should be pressed basically from the back of your head to where your upper arm is kind of parallel to the floor or just slightly under.
Okay.
Now it is the press behind it is king for side delt. It, in my opinion, blows away side laterals. But that doesn't mean that side laterals aren't good and that they don't work. All I'm saying is if you have a side delt deficiency.
Yeah.
If you're doing side delts and you do them prior to press behind neck and you're doing both of them right with good form, you're going to be able to bring up your side delts pretty damn good. If you got a front delt weakness, then you want to press from the front, or you want to press with a neutral grip.
That's what I do.
A lot of machines for that right now that are great for that.
My dumbbells.
You
got to
be careful with that.
Dumbbells.
You got to be careful with, okay.
Because I can get them. I don't do the Arnold, but I bring them down to like right there when I'm pressing. So they're very neutral. If I can't really do a barbell because of that front delt, then it starts getting to that bicep tendon. So I'm not really good at pressing from right here. But if I bring it back and I'm pressing from right here, I can do it. But I can't go. I don't have the flexibility to go behind the neck.
And I think, too, another thing to point out is there are different upright benches for shoulder pressing. Short one where you can let your shoulders hang over or your head hang over so you can lean back more is going to give you more front delt movement or front delt activation, versus if you have a high back to the bench where you can't put your head back and you can't get your shoulders over the back of the bench.
Yeah,
that's going to push that activation more to the side delt. Doesn't take it away from the, completely take it away from the front, but it pushes it to the side.
Matt Marshall says, all props to Skip. Since watching him on those, watching those on his DVD, behind the neck Smith machine presses have been my go-to delt exercise, and it's worked.
Nice.
He's grown his delts too, so more power to him for sure. What about, I haven't seen in a while, and maybe it's because I just haven't seen the machine in a while. You remember the hammer strength overhead press, and you're actually sitting in a chair that's angled back. You ever see, people will sit, they'll straddle the chair and they do it facing in. What do you think about those?
I have not done them, so I don't know what the angle is.
I thought we all did that in like 2002.
Maybe I didn't for some reason. There are just sometimes things that I see that I just look and I go, eh, I don't like it.
That's not
good. I'm not even going to bother with it. I would guess that if you're sitting upright, I don't know. I'd have to look at the angle. I don't want to guess. Because being at an incline, even though it's inclined, the press is inclined back as well, I'd actually have to see where that sits. Off the top of my head, if you were facing forward and you were sitting upright, then you would kind of be pressing back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, as an example, if I'm pressing behind the neck on a Smith machine, I'm going to make sure, and it's angled because 9 out of 10 are angled, I'm pressing back. I'm not going to press forward if I want more side delt activation.
Okay.
The other thing is, and this gets overlooked a lot too, because we tend to use more, I think, for exercises like this, we tend to use more machines or Smith machines, but an overhead push press is really, really good. If you have weak shoulders and you want to get your poundages up, overhead push press to full lockout. It's huge because a lot of times people don't press not only with chest, but even more so with shoulder press. They don't press to full lockout. And I tell you, take a lightweight, put 25s on each side, and press to full lockout when you go to warm up for a shoulder press next time. And tell me that you don't have a pump in your shoulders after a set or two that you're like, oh my God, full lockout. Full lockout.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. No, I was just wondering. I was thinking about it because I've been focusing a lot on my chest work. I do the push-pull legs thing now, and I had the best chest day yesterday, Skip. So much so I had to take a day off today. Like, I was not physically spent, but like CNS, I just didn't have that, like, I got to get in the gym feeling. I felt very hesitant. I was like, oh no, it's time for a day off. But I was thinking about it more because I do the same thing, and I've been focusing so much on chest, so much on these presses that I've been working on, that I hadn't thought as much about delts. And I was thinking about, maybe I want to do something a little bit different. I had always found, for me, I had overhead press with dumbbells was my ego lift for many years because I could do a lot of weight with it. And my delts were really strong, but my chest was also weaker. I think that it got, a lot of shoulders were getting worked during my chest movement. So, I mean, shoulders are okay for me now, but I feel like they used to stand out more than they do at this time.
Well, I think sometimes, large majority of the time, show me someone with a weak chest and I'll show you someone with strong delts.
Yeah, yeah.
It happens. So, and early on when I was in high school, I had a buddy's, the reason a big part of the reason that I do what I do and my love for bodybuilding. Nothing will light a fire into your ass than when you're second to someone all the time. He was the biggest dude, the strongest dude. He could do everything great. He was my best friend. He always got all the attention. I fucking hated it. But he had a horrible chest to the point where it was like an insecurity for him. But he could walk in at 16 years old, pick up 135 and start pressing it over his head like it was nothing.
Fuck yeah, he could. Yeah.
But had a paper thin chest that never grew. Why? Because the shoulders were so strong.
Yep.
That they did most of the work, even on bench pressing, even on incline work. Because at that time, of course, it didn't help that, you know, mechanics, we were just pushing. We didn't really know the ins and outs of what we needed to do specifically for form. But even when you do, it's difficult to get away from those, you know, from strong delts. It's tough.
Did he ever, did he keep training? And if so, did he ever correct it?
What he did was he ended up walking on at Michigan State, and
damn,
he was a good football player. He walked on at Michigan State, and he got attention by grabbing Tony Mandrich, fucked with him and threw him down or something. He got up and he grabbed Tony Mandrich's face mask and pulled it in and kept fucking hitting it, and Tony couldn't get him off of him.
Oh, shit.
And he got fucking mad, finally grabbed him and slammed him down on the ground, and that got the coach's attention. So he played for Michigan State for 3 years, I think.
Oh, wow.
Didn't go anywhere or do anything with it, but at the same time, make no mistake, he walked on and he played, and you know, he played for State and they got a ring out of it. So
damn.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I had to pre-fatigue. I did, you know, pec deck first. Mm-hmm. And that made a difference for me. That gave me the activation I needed. It was the year after that picture I showed you. I was okay. Like, man, I gotta grow my chest. I trained with my coach, Rick Wetmore, for an entire offseason. Every time that we trained chest, we started out at pec deck, and I felt I hated it because I was like, man, I can't bench as much as I know I'm capable of. And then, but it paid off and my chest grew.
I do that now. I've been doing that for 6-8 months, and it's, I do it primarily. Well, I do it for that reason, but I also do it because it is a safety thing for me.
Okay.
9 out of 10 of the muscles that I open with, or my training sessions, I open with an isolation move first.
Okay. Yeah.
And then move to my compound movements. The only exception is quads, because I have, when I try to do leg extensions first, I have gravel in my right knee.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. It doesn't hurt, but I can hear it and feel it.
I do the same thing as you then. And for me, in part, it's warming up, and part, it's pre-fatiguing. What about, have you ever tried hamstring curls first before squats?
I have not first, but I do something weird. I love training questions, by the way. So if someone's getting bored, I apologize, but I love talking about training.
Me too.
I do something weird with my, weird to a lot of people. It's not weird to me, but I don't train hamstrings and quads separately. Okay, I go into my leg workout and I usually, I warm up between leg extension, leg curls, and get my knees warm and all that sort of shit. But I open with a compound for quads, and then I'll either do my hamstrings second or third or fourth movement, but it's usually second or third. It's in the middle. What I like to do is I like to come to an isolation movement in the middle so I can actually catch my breath after I either have been squatting, hack squats, leg press, something like that. So my hamstring movements will be in, like, interspersed at some point with my quad workout.
Yeah, yeah. The reason I ask is because that's what I do a lot of times, is hamstrings first. And the reason, well, I should say a hamstring curl first. And the reason I do it is because John Meadows had said that that's what he does. And he said, anybody who's ever got any knee issues, do hamstring curls and then do your squats. He's like, I guarantee your knees will feel a lot better. So
same with calves. I did the same thing with calves. If you warm up the calf, people don't understand. They think that the calf, it only involves flexion at the ankle, but it doesn't. It involves flexion at the knee as well.
Okay. Yeah.
So when you're doing hamstring curls, your calves have to help. It's much like the bicep at the shoulder.
Yeah.
The
calf is over
the shoulder. Exactly. It's a lot of the same thing. The calf attaches over the back of the knee. So when you're doing leg curls, you're getting calf involvement. You don't think so. But every now and then you'll get a cramp in your calf while you're doing hamstring curl. That's why. But anyway, it's a very good idea. You're getting blood into your lower body before getting knees and everything else warmed up.
Yeah.
The other thing I did is, and coming back to the point earlier, we're talking about lower back injuries.
Uh-huh.
Train abs prior to legs.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because then you're going to warm up not only your abs, but you're getting movement in your lower back and your erectors as well as an antagonist. And you're just, you're less vulnerable coming in because you're not as cold. Your, the muscles supporting your spine, your abs, your erectors, your obliques, they're also getting blood into them and they're getting warm, which makes for less of a vulnerability too.
I've even had to, like on that similar note, I've done sets of like light glute work, glute activation work before I train something, like even before I train back, for that same reason. Cause for me, I found that that's the weak link in my body, is that the glutes will want to shut off. So mm-hmm. when you're talking about like that T-bar row, I've torn my back up with it. Different reason though, because my glutes would shut off and then the lower back is the only thing trying to hold my shit together, you know?
Yeah. I had a, Dr. Jake.
Yeah. Yeah.
The chiropractor. He would poke me in my fucking glutes while I was doing bent over rows.
Ooh,
to make sure my S2H. Glutes were, I know, exactly. I know. No, we don't need it for that. I've wanted to say that for like 3 months, but I can't because he's here. Basically just reminding me during the set, keep your glutes tight.
Yeah.
Glutes tight all the time.
Dude.
Because otherwise your lower back is taking so much more. If your glutes are tight and they're activated, then your base or your foundation through your hips is so much more solid. Otherwise, the lower back is doing far more work than it should.
Absolutely. Well, that's it, guys. This is it for Blood, Sweat, and Gear. Skip, what do you have going on this next week? How's your? You said you're how many weeks out again now?
8 weeks.
I didn't know you were going to tell us, by the way.
Yeah, I know it wasn't. But you know what? Everything is locked in now. The cool thing is the dates of the shows are finally fixed.
Nice.
I was dealing with the show dates being pushed and not sure. Now they're fixed. And they're big shows. They're on.
Good.
So yeah, everything is right. The arrangements, the bookings, everything is on. And it's good.
Well, so, I'll be excited to follow along.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. I'm enjoying the really, really enjoying the process to the point where I keep reminding myself, I just got to milk this because this is just the shit. And I love prepping. I fucking love prepping.
I hear you.
So the fact that I'm prepping longer, I don't even honestly fucking care. I really like, and I know that when it's done, I'm going to be bummed.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, you know,
well, we'll have to do a podcast on that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, guys, for another episode of Blood, Sweat, and Gear with Skip Hill, go to teamskip.com. Of course, check out our sponsors, truenutrition.com and getazoff.com. We've got all that stuff down in the show notes for another episode of Blood, Sweat, and Gear. Scott McNally, Skip Hill. We'll see you guys.